sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
I made a lot of mistakes in my first 6 months. And started to figure things out. And when I, after about 5 years, I took over a team of pre-sales consultants, sales engineers, discovered that many of them were making many of the same mistakes, and there was very little training. So I created a training, and that was about 2010, so it was over 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I created a training program for them, and over the course of the next, you know, almost decade, What sort of evolved was six patterns of behavior, habits. And I felt for a long time, I had this book inside me and it had to get out. And finally, in fact, Andy, I tried a couple times to write the book and couldn't, it was so hard to get myself focused.
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. That was Chris White. Chris is founder and CEO of Tech Sales Advisor, and he's the author of a book titled The 6 Habits of Highly Effective Sales Engineers. And in this conversation from the archives of the Sales Enablement Podcast, Chris and I talk about the increasing importance of the sales engineer, the solution consultant, in winning new business. We dive into what the responsibilities are of the sales engineer in terms of orchestrating the technical win in each opportunity. We then dig into the 6 essential habits of sales engineers that Chris spells out in his book, including how SEs can partner more effectively with their sales counterparts and how an SE should conduct their effective discovery in preparation for a demonstration. So we get into all of this and much, much more. But before we get to Chris, I want to remind you to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you subscribe, we'd certainly appreciate it if you could also give us your feedback about how we're doing by leaving us a review. We'd really appreciate it. So thank you. All right, let's jump into it with Chris.
Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Andy. Delighted to be here.
It's good to see you again. So we're going to talk about sales engineers today.
Indeed.
So you've written a book titled, well, for sales engineers, titled The 6 Habits of Highly Effective Sales Engineers. So a very Covey-ish type title there.
Indeed.
And so why this book? Why now?
Well, let me start with why the book. I've thought for, honestly, a decade plus that the sales engineer is the most underserved role in the sales enablement and sales training space. And in fact, my story is the story of many. I started out as an IT professional, software developer, enterprise architect for 15 years. And then I got into pre-sales and I thought it was going to be brilliant because I could move a mouse and talk at the same time. and I found out very quickly that there's a lot more to this role than just being good in front of an audience. And I made a lot of mistakes in my first 6 months, and started to figure things out. And when I after about 5 years, I took over a team of pre-sales consultants, sales engineers, discovered that many of them were making many of the same mistakes, and there was very little training. So I created a training, and that was about 2010, so it was over 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I created a training program for them, and over the course of the next, almost decade, what sort of evolved was six patterns of behavior, six habits. And I felt for a long time, I had this book inside me and it had to get out. And finally, in fact, Andy, I tried a couple times to write the book and couldn't, it was so hard to get myself focused. And, right. and I actually stumbled upon a book writing coach, a publishing coach. And he said, Chris, if you do exactly what I tell you to do, your book will be published as a number one best-selling release on Amazon in 2 months or less. And honestly, I wasn't sure I believed him, but I really wanted to. And so he sort of kicked me in the pants and lo and behold, out popped a book. So, and that was 2 years ago. And honestly, I think the timing could not have been better because there, I do see sort of a newfound emphasis and momentum around the profession of pre-sales and sales engineering. So allow me to pause there for a minute. Does that adequately answer the first part of the question anyways?
Oh yeah. 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 No, it's good. We'll have more questions. So, so you said when you took your first sales engineering job that you had never considered yourself a salesperson, and you actually sort of thought perhaps it was beneath you, I think was the words you used, beneath me. So why the switch? It sounded like a little bit like you had sort of, I call it maybe career ADD, and that you wanted more variety in the types of things you were doing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's actually a really good question, Andy. And for starters, and you'll actually see a pattern here. I got to a point in my career, I was a consultant, very well paid, but I was unhappy. And why was I unhappy? Because I would land on a project, I'd be there for 3 or 4 months, sort of figure things out, and then I just wanted to jump to the next project. And the idea of being in one place for, you know, an extended period of time just felt like a jail sentence to me. Mm-hmm. Whereas a number of the consultants I worked with, they longed to have a 3-year contract, a 4-year contract. I was like, oh my gosh, like just, I couldn't do that. So I was not a turn the crank kind of guy, right? I thought there was something wrong with me, Andy. I really did. So I found a career, like a professional career counseling coach, if you will. I went through a series of, you know, tests and discovery. And he basically said, there's nothing wrong with you at all, Chris. You just got a number of talents and skills that need an outlet. And you probably should be like a technical spokesperson for a product company. And on my journey, I had discovered that I loved presenting. I loved pitching, presenting, giving quote demonstrations. And so this idea of being in a technical pre-sales role where I was actually paid to stand up in front of people and do demonstrations. Oh my gosh, like that sounds perfect to me. Here's the part that I didn't understand. There's actually a process to sales. Right? The job wasn't just me standing up in front of people and being the smart person in the room, right? It wasn't about me showing off my expertise. It was more about helping customers understand how our solution can help them. And there's a process to this. And that was the part that sort of hit me in the face. But yeah, I mean, the idea of just being airdropped in, doing a demonstration, I was excited about that part.
All right. So let's dive into the book. So you say the number one goal of technical pre-sales is to get the technical win. So define that for us and let's dive into that a bit.
Yeah. Another good question. So I define the technical win as, if I can use the word convincing our prospects, our audience, our customers, beyond a reasonable doubt that our products, our solutions, our people, our company are the right choice for them, can help them accomplish what they're trying to accomplish, achieve their objectives, address their problems. That's what I refer to as the technical win. Now, a lot of people actually take me to task on that a little bit because their argument is we shouldn't just be focusing on the technology. And they're 100% correct. This is not just about the technology. Does it align with the business objectives? Will the talent, will the technology, will the solution help them meet the business objectives, the objectives of the stakeholder? So to me, getting the technical win simply means, does it satisfy the need? Does it fit the requirements and help, you know, address what they're trying to accomplish? So to me, that's the role, or that's the objective. Does that make sense to you, Andy?
I think maybe put it in a little bit different context, because I think that and this is, I think, is a hard thing for people to understand, because certainly if you're selling a tech product, there's a, you know, you call it a technical win. And it's a good term for it, but you know, when buyers are going through their process, is, you know, they have, I say they have three stages that buyers go through. And we can have a longer conversation later about how we don't map to those necessarily in the way we sell to people. But this idea of a technical win, I think, is important in that context, in that the three stages buyers have is basically they first have to understand what it is they're trying to do, right? What's the challenge we have? What are the potential outcomes that we can achieve? The second phase is, well, okay, now that we've defined what the thing is, how are we going to do that? And yeah, this technical win really comes at the end of that how's stage, right? And yes, it's not divorced from business, because they go hand in hand. Yeah. You know, any evaluation of a technical solution has a business component to it as well. So this idea that sellers need to get their minds wrapped around that aligns with what you talk about in the book is that in every deal you're working on as a seller, as a pre-sales engineer, is you want to get your solution designed into the buyer's vision of success.
Absolutely.
And absolutely. So that's the goal, right? And this happens in every buying situation, certainly in a complex level, maybe not so much in transactional, though actually the science of decision-making says it happens even on a transactional level, is people go through steps of defining what the problem is they're trying to solve, identifying a number of options to help reach the objectives they have to solve that problem, and then choosing which one of those are a best fit.
Absolutely.
And then the third order consideration is, who are we going to do that with? See, I think the idea of a technical win is almost product agnostic to some degree. Because when the customer makes the decision about, well, this is how we want to solve the problem, it's not necessarily vendor specific. I mean, the net result is, if you've done a good job of influencing their vision of what their vision of success is for what the outcomes are, and you're embodied in that and embedded in that, then you're going to get the deal.
Yeah. Well, and if I may, I mean, I love what you just said there. I mean, one of the things that we talk about in a number of the workshops that I run is let's first focus on what does the customer need to believe and buy into before they're even ready to consider your product, right? If we can align on a logical, on a contextual level, right, and we have a shared understanding of the problem and the solution, right? Forget about the product for a moment, right? This is the problem. And if you had this solution, that would be the right answer. If we can agree on that, then the product almost becomes the logical consequence, right? To me, it's just that's the logical jump. Yeah. And Andy, you've heard me say this before, I think, right? One of my favorite sayings, he or she who buys a shovel doesn't want a shovel. They want a hole, but they don't just want a hole. They want a fence or a tree, but they don't just want a fence or a tree. They want privacy or they want shade. But we get so focused on the shiny shovel. We want to talk about the blade and the handle. And the reality is most people don't care about the shovel. And those who do oftentimes don't have the budget, right? So to me, getting the technical win is, here's how we're going to help you get the privacy you're looking for with our approach, with our solutions, right? And ultimately, yes, with our tools, right? But that's secondary to helping you get to where you're trying to go. Does that resonate?
Well, I think that the nuance I might put on that is just that you're going to help them get the privacy with this approach. And the key is, as a seller, is you're selling this approach and it's not identified by your product nomenclature, right? This is the best approach. Yeah. Oh, by the way, when we get to this point, yes, this is what our product does or does in part or whatever, you know, whatever part of the solution we are. But you know, this whole idea of the customer getting this technical win, I believe, in my mind, is what I'll call a design in, right? You're getting the design win is being designed into the buyer's business, being designed into the solution that they're envisioning, is that it's really sort of, it's a battle of ideas. It's not a battle of products. And this is really a challenge for sellers, is to be able to divorce themselves from just pushing their product and talking about solutions that best fit the buyer.
Could not agree more. And you know, Andy, as you were sharing, one of the thoughts that came to mind is consider the buying organization and the individuals, the committees involved in making particularly an enterprise B2B, you know, purchase decision. You've got your executive sponsors, your decision makers, but typically you've got some key experts within the organization that the decision makers are looking to, right, to help guide the decision. To me, getting the technical win is convincing the and working with the experts within that organization to your point, to define what the right solution looks like, right? And convince them that our solution is the one that will fit that mold. To me, and that's who the, so if I sell a high-tech product, who are the experts that I'm working with? Probably the high-tech architects and engineers within the organization. If I sell maybe a marketing technology, who are the experts? Maybe it's the digital, you know, content, you know, manager or director or something of that nature. Does that resonate with you, Andy?
Well, yeah, I mean, in part. I think that at least in my mind, a better way to think about this is that rather than you're not trying to, I believe, and this is my experience, is you're not trying to convince the buyer that your particular feature, let's say, you know, needs to be included in their final spec of their requirements that they're building, but you're trying to influence how they look at the problem so that it becomes sort of the logical conclusion that your approach to things as a product and a service or whatever is best aligned with what they want to achieve in their business outcomes. And so they have a series of choices they have to make and trade-offs, right? Throughout the entire buying process, they're making trade-offs. And your job is really to influence the choices they make that precede making a decision, because they have all these options. And I think this is again, not getting in the weeds too much, but as a seller and a sales engineer, this is the approach you have to have, which is, you know, the ultimate thing that the buyer is going to come up with is some sort of final specification or requirements document or something that illustrates, is the basis on which they have sort of this vision of success. And the components of that, as much as possible, you want to use the value, the questions you ask, the insights you provide, and so on, to influence their choice about each of those trade-offs.
I completely agree. And I love to use the term the disruptive truth, right? The more we can bring disruptive truths about how best to solve those problems, how best to think about how to solve those problems, right? And to your point, broaden our prospects' perspectives on how best to address the issues that they're trying to address or solve those problems.
Yeah, I mean, there's been research done on decision making, in particular by somebody named Paul Nutt, who I don't know if he's still alive or not. I know he's an emeritus at Ohio State at one point. But one of the experts on corporate decision making, and really put together this sort of idea of, but you know, people evaluate these options, you know, prior to making a decision about how they're going to solve there. And And the thing that's really interesting is he found that oftentimes when the options are presented to stakeholders or decision makers to make a choice about how they want to proceed before they decide, you know, this is a pre-decision to deciding what vendor to go with, is that in an overwhelming majority of cases is they basically only present two options to the decision maker. And so when you sort of think about, oh, well, that's now let's you know, walk that back a little bit, because there's data that exists. Yeah, I just saw a report just last week, a couple years old, but I think it's still valid. That was saying that 40 to 50% of deals in a B2B pipeline end up in no decision. So if you assume that somebody has two choices, one of those choices is always to do nothing, right? So as a seller, if you, and as a pre-sale engineer, if you do a really good job of framing and influencing the choices and the trade-offs the buyer makes, is that when they put together that final requirements document, you want a third party to be able to look at that and say, wow, Chris and his team did a fantastic job. They're all over this, right? And then the choice is, yeah, we go with Chris or we do nothing.
Right. Right. And I think a big part of that is truly understanding what are they actually trying to accomplish, right? And being the experts, right? Delivering a better way to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish than they even knew might was possible.
Yeah, well, I think that fundamentally becomes the role of sellers to some degree. I mean, we can sort of break it down even further in terms of what the actual role is. But when you sort of a day-to-day, when you're interacting with buyers as a, again, either pre-sale or a seller, is the bar is actually, at least from my perspective, pretty low. In that what the buyer's expectation is, and this gets the whole thing, you know, people talk about, oh, buyers don't want to talk with sellers anymore and so on, which I don't think is the case. They just don't want to talk to sellers who can't help them, right? And so, and that seems like as a seller, your job is you just need to be able to contribute something of value above and beyond what the buyer can find online.
Tell me something I don't already know.
And so as the, again, as a pre-sales engineer, as a seller, that is, in my mind, is a pretty low bar. But it seems to be one that we have a hard time sort of consistently getting over, because at least based on the surveys you see of the dissatisfaction that the buyers have talking to sellers. And partly, I think, because yeah, people are going in and just flogging their products as opposed to being this consultative, trusted advisor. Hey, let's make sure I understand before I sell anything. Let's make it really sure I understand. Yeah, what is the most important thing to you, and how can I help you get that?
Exactly. And I think pre-sales sales engineers can help balance that out a little bit, right? And in fact, many of the pre-sales engineers that I work with, they're so concerned about misleading the customer. They're so concerned about, quote, overselling, that they almost overcompensate. And yes. At times, they offer cautionary advice where cautionary advice isn't warranted, right? One of my favorite sayings is, thou shalt not voluntarily confess thy sins, right?
Well, but you address that in the book, though. You say that sometimes, yeah, I think as part of your habit number one with partnering with your sales counterpart is that you give examples of how to extract yourself from what a, you know, an overpromise and overcommitment a seller may have made.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, exactly. Which is always a delicate balance.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, as a sales engineer, we tend to walk a fine line between, you know, at the technical side of our brain and the what I'll call the salesy side of our brain, right? What customers are asking, what our sales counterparts are asking or expecting of us. So we sort of live in this world of balancing, sort of competing objectives and principles, if I can use that term, for sure.
Well, who does the customer trust more, the SE or the seller?
I think customers inherently trust the technical sales engineer, pre-sales engineer, call them what they may, more so than the sales professional. In fact, and I remind the sales engineers that I work with, it's actually unfair. It's unfair for our sales counterparts, our account executive sales counterparts, because they are presumed guilty until proven innocent, right?
Yeah. Yes.
So they are swimming upstream in terms of building trust. So we actually can help the sales team become viewed more as trusted advisors, right? By stepping in at certain times and in certain ways. We also need to understand that that's one of our superpowers as a sales engineer, right? Is that we're sort of extended that I think that trust inherently. Go ahead, you were going to say something.
Well, yeah, it was just sort of, so how should a salesperson, if that's the case, which I agree is oftentimes the case, is, you know, sort of technical experts given sort of the benefit of the doubt over opposed to salespeople, but, you know, how should technical experts, a sales engineer, sort of manage the seller in order to help the seller gain their own credibility?
So it's an interesting question. I mean, I think there are a couple ways. I think, first of all, one of the things we have to make sure that we're always doing is we need to represent ourselves and our companies and our colleagues in the highest regard at all times. And I've literally seen some sales engineers say things that almost are, let's just say, sort of negative, or they make negative connotations about their, or subtle comments about their sales counterpart, or maybe
in front of the buyer you're talking about.
In front of the buyer.
Yeah. That's in front of the buyer. Yeah.
So we always need to present a united front. I think to me the relationship between SE and AE, sales and pre-sales, is so critical. And we need to put this stuff on the table and talk it through, right? I think sales needs to be more at peace with the fact that they do sometimes struggle to build credibility and trust with their sales counterparts. And whereas their engineers are extended that trust more readily and have more of an equal role in front of the customer and with the customer. But when given that opportunity, the sales engineer, again, needs to make sure that we don't focus too much on the technology, too much on the details. I mean, you know, an article I read recently is the problem with your product demonstration is it's all about your product.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, it needs to be about your customer, right? And what the customer's trying to accomplish. So to me, this is where I think both parties need to take a step towards the middle. Sales needs to take a step towards their technical pre-sales counterpart. Pre-sales needs to take a step towards their sales counterpart. Sales needs to be a little less salesy. Technical needs, the pre-sales engineers need to be a little less technical.
Yeah, I mean, sales needs to be a lot less salesy, not just a little less salesy. And that's the subject of my new book coming out in February. A little plug. So let's go into your habits. So you have six habits. Habit number one is partner with your sales counterpart. Habit number two is, and we'll dig in the first two most in depth, is to probe into any request for a demonstration, really talking about technical discovery. Habit three is prepare with effectiveness and efficiency in mind. Absolutely. Habit four, the most consistently successful SEs practice their demos religiously. Yep. Habit five is to perform under the spotlight. Now, this is sort of interesting. Maybe we'll take a little digression here before I go back to the first two habits. Is, you're addressing sort of there's a performance aspect to selling, whether you're an SE or a salesperson.
I sincerely believe that there are very specific things that we need to say, show, and do, and specific things we need to avoid saying, showing, and doing in order to get the technical win, or at the very least, in order to adequately deliver an effective message and achieve the goal of the meeting. And I do believe that whenever we engage with a customer, to a certain degree, we are on stage, right? This is what I tell the sales engineers I work with. At some point, the spotlight shines on you. And in that moment, it's your time to perform. So yes, I do believe it's a performance. And you know, one of the newer concepts that I'm kicking around, Andy, is you want to win more deals, win more meetings. Like if we were to break down the some of the elements of a successful deal, it breaks into successful meetings. So let's win every meeting.
Oh yeah, no, I break it down even further. It's actually a matter of moments. Is you have to be excellent in the moment, not just in the meeting.
Yeah, and so I think, and unfortunately, a lot of people who are recruited into the sales engineer role are because they have the technical expertise. And there's a lot of companies out there looking for technical expertise. They may or may not have the sales expertise. And many of them don't understand that there is a difference between a sales demonstration, a sales conversation, and the conversations you're used to having where you're just providing or the purveyor of technical information. You're just the purveyor of product information. That's no longer your job. From my vantage point, it is a sales role. And so we need to understand.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The positioning, I think, is important because, yeah, someone who's recruited technical people into sales for quite a long time is, and even not just, you know, IT folks, but yeah, hardcore design engineers into sales is they always have this reluctance that it is sales, to your point earlier. And the way I help people sort of come to grips with it is to say, well, what do you think selling is? And it's always about, you know, convincing or persuading somebody to buy something they don't necessarily need. It's like, well, no, it's you're a problem solver.
Exactly.
Customer has a problem. Your job is to help them understand the problem and decide what's the best way to solve it. Isn't that what you do as an engineer? Oh yeah, that's sort of the way we do as an engineer. It's internal, but yeah, we have problems and we're solving problems on a daily basis. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, very early in my workshops, we established this right out of the gate. First and foremost, you are in sales. And if you're not comfortable with that, to sell is to solve. And to sell is to serve. Mm-hmm. And if you're not at peace with that, then maybe you're not in the right profession, right? But at the end of the day, and I sincerely, you know, we talk a lot about this notion of servant leadership. Mm-hmm. I think more and more of us need to think of servant salespersonship, if I can say that word, right? We are
servant. That's five words. Yeah.
If we think of ourselves as servant salespeople, we are going to do much better. That's really, we are here to serve. We are here to help our customers make the best decisions they can, whether that's in our favor or not, right?
I wouldn't take the word leadership out of that. I think that sales inherently is a leadership position. I mean, it's you know, if you're too subservient and passive as a seller, then you're not going to be in a good position to really, you know, A, earn the trust of the buyer that you need and to help influence the decisions that they need to make. I mean, you to some degree, you as a seller are leading someone, and you can lead from behind, which is, I think, the role of the seller, leading them to a decision about what represents a good decision for them.
I completely agree. And by the way, I love the fact that you use the word subservient, because I think that's an important distinction, right? To be a servant salesperson doesn't mean to be subservient, right? In fact, and I say this all the time, right? People don't always make the best decisions for themselves. They're not always sure what the best decisions are, right? They need help making decisions. That's one of our jobs, is to help them find the best decisions for themselves. And in that way, we are leaders. In fact, we can take the lead in helping them solve their problems because we're the experts, right? Just like if I hire a plumber, I don't expect him or her to be a subservient, you know, service provider. I expect him or her to come in and say, this is how we're going to solve that problem.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. People can hear this and think, well, geez, okay, how do I parse all this? Because on one hand, Andy, you always talk about the problem with sellers being too salesy, too persuasion oriented, without really first understanding. But on the other hand, you're talking also about sort of leading from behind. And it's like, well, yeah, they all sort of, they all come together, right? Is not to overuse the term, but this idea of we talk about trust, we talk about being a trusted advisor, we talk about, and as a seller and a sales engineer, you both have to get into that position where the buyer says, look, you've got something to add. You talk about, disrupting their thinking. They have something to add that I hadn't really thought about before in this context. And yeah, they understand what I'm trying to do. And that's a really interesting thought that's going to lead me in a different direction.
And I couldn't agree more. And Andy, as you've said those words, the one word that came to mind for me, which ties all these things together, is priority. Who's the priority in the conversation? Who's the priority in my recommendation and my words of advice? Am I the priority because I just want to sell something? Or am I saying this for your, do I sincerely believe that this is what's best for you? Am I speaking because I truly believe that this is in your best interest, right? And if I, and you can't fake that, right? This isn't like, a sales tactic, right? It's a mindset. You need to sincerely want to help people, right? And you need to be an expert in helping people. And if you sincerely take that approach, I think people recognize, wow, like this person's actually trying to give me the advice that will help me. And to me, it's all about demonstrating to the people we're talking to and dealing with that, look, you're the priority in this conversation. My advice, my recommendations are all based on what I think is in your best interest. Whether it's right for me or not is secondary, right? So yeah. to me, that's, and anybody who might be listening to this, that here's the one thing we know. Unfortunately, we all, us in sales, we have commission breath, right? We show up and they can smell it on our breath. Like, whoo, like, you know? Like, because everything we say is tied to a commission. So the people we work with immediately, their default is to assume you're just saying this because you want to sell me something, right? So we have to demonstrate throughout the sales process that they're the priority in the conversation. They're the priority in our recommendation. Does that resonate with you, Andy?
Oh, yeah. No, of course. I mean, this is it's like you've read my books. Yeah, I mean, this is the challenge, right? This is sort of the ongoing challenge, sort of this like Jekyll and Hyde thing that is ever present in sales and has been probably for hundreds of years, and if not longer, and is still perhaps the biggest problem that sellers have today is this perception of them by buyers that they're out for their own self-interest first. And buyers don't come across or come upon those beliefs independent of experiences. Sure, there's popular culture portrays salespeople a certain way, but they also have a set of experiences they're drawing upon. And so the reputation we have as sellers, unfortunately, is one that we've earned. And using that as the collective we. But we have the power to change that as well.
Completely agree.
I mean, just following the steps that you've talked about is, being service oriented is changing the perspective. I mean, here's a very simple one that for sellers to think about and wrote about this in my second book is you know, selling is not something you do to a buyer. It's something you do with a buyer. And that change of perspective aligns with what we were just talking about. But it does shape and should shape the actions that you take and your behaviors. Yeah. Because you're thinking, well, I'm not imposing myself. You do something to somebody, you're basically imposing yourself on them, right? Yeah. Well, that means you're falling back to the old persuasion-based, you know, sleazy techniques, say overly salesy, overly hypey. And it's like, yeah, everybody inherently resists those as human beings. I mean, Jonah Berger, a professor at Wharton School, wrote about this in his latest book, The Catalyst, is, yeah, everybody in the world basically has this resistance to being persuaded. So why do we still basically train people to do that, sellers to do that?
Yep. Because that's what we think is the right thing to teach.
Well, but when you think about it, I mean, this is the part that yeah, I keep coming back on. And this is sort of the subject, I don't know, another plug for my new book coming in February is that, you know, these set of behaviors that I label as salesy behaviors, we all sort of know what those are. We've felt it. We've perhaps indulged in them ourselves from time to time. That don't work with buyers, for the most part, is those are not innate human behaviors. Those are learned behaviors. And yeah. It's human nature to want to connect with another human being. It's human nature to want to ask questions and be interested and understand another human being. It's human nature to want to understand and to generously give, right? To help somebody else. And somehow you think, oh, that should be easier to train people and sellers in those behaviors than in these salesy behaviors.
Well, and I think a lot of it has to do with the pressures that come sort of down the chain, right? So I think a lot of it is driven by management who thinks the right thing to do is, you know, either get out the stick or get out the carrot. And, you know, unfortunately, this is the tide that we are swimming against. Those like you and me who do believe there's a better way to go about this. So.
Yeah, well, it's what keeps authors and consultants and trainers and so on in business. Indeed. But it actually would be great to have the need for that type of work go away.
Yeah.
I say that as someone who yeah, makes a living, but it's yeah, we can make a change. We can make the decision that it's time to stop these types of behaviors that are so counterproductive. And it doesn't take that much of a will to do that. But it's unfortunately, as you talked about, sort of anchored in the belief that somehow being these prototypical stereotyped sales person works. And you know, it's not a zero-sum game. It's not like it never works or always works. It's like, you know, people need to buy things. Yeah, people hold their noses and buy from sellers they don't think it's an ideal interaction, but yeah, people still manage to sell using those old fashioned behaviors. But indeed. It's, we collectively as a sales profession, corporate leaders, you could make a decision that, yeah, the time is now and we can just stop these things.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hopefully all the work that you're doing with, you know, with these podcasts and the book that's coming out, I know shortly, we'll certainly continue to turn the tide a little bit. Unfortunately, I do think it's human nature. One of the things that we talk about in my workshops is this notion that, look, we natively default to self. It's just how we're wired. And some of these things that we're talking about, they should come natural, but they're not always convenient for whatever reason, right? It's not necessarily convenient to put our agenda second, right? It's not necessarily convenient to work hard to understand the people that we're meeting with and working with, as opposed to just wanting to, let me just tell you all about me and my product and my stuff, right?
Well, but I think that certainly there's, you know, you look at the distribution of personalities in the world, is there's a certain segment of them that are self-centered, right? But based on everything I've read and you know, in terms of papers and research stuff online is in books is that that's not the majority of people in the world. I mean, the people I said is you think about just simple act of making a friend, right? Is yeah. Often when you're trying to make a friend, which is something, yeah, most people in the world are fairly adept at. They have friends. Again, there are exceptions, but in the main, when you meet somebody new in a social situation, is the first thing you do is pitch them on yourself? I mean, generally, no. I mean, you ask them a question. You're sort of interested in them. You're maybe willing to explore if there might be an opportunity to, as I said, for a friendship to exist or some sort of relationship. So you try to find common ground. You ask questions about them. That's normal human behavior. And then, but we put people into a sales situation and it's like they suspend that.
And
I think that then becomes a challenge. It's like, no, actually it's going to work for you better is to be yourself, right?
Yeah.
Be who you are as a human being. And you'll find that's a quicker path to connecting, building trust, credibility with the buyer than showing up and throwing up.
Yeah. Yeah. For some reason, we seem to lose our humanity when we step, quote, into our role. And I don't understand that. One of the things that I've been saying is it's more important than ever before to be human in our jobs. In fact, it's more okay than ever before to be human in our jobs because our personal and professional lives have come together like never before. Right. And yet we still seem to, it's almost like we need to take on this new persona because we're in a certain role. And nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah, well, I think it's a great point. And I think it you look at any job in life, right? Not a profession necessarily, but any role we fill in life, I believe there are two aspects to it, not just me. Social scientists believe it as well, we have two roles in that. There's the role itself, but then there's also the human part of it. And you know, like we need to think about the fact that perhaps one of the things we're missing in the way that we help train people, enable people in the sales profession and other professions perhaps as well, is that we assume that they have these fundamental human skills that are needed to connect with other people. And I think it's a false assumption. And we shouldn't make that. We shouldn't assume people know how to connect. We shouldn't assume people know how to be interested in other people, be curious, display their curiosity. Yet these are things that people can be educated about, and they are behaviors that people can adopt. But we have to spend more time on it. Instead, we just throw them into the sales onboarding and say, hey, here's what you need to do, without this grounding in these fundamental human skills, this humanity, as you talk about it, that will help them succeed.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think, does it start with the organization itself? Does the organization itself not recognize individuals as humans and make people feel comfortable as humans in their role? So as a result, they just go out into the market and sort of treat the people that they're dealing with in a similar manner?
Well, I think there's an element of it. Yeah, for sure. But I think, we also have certain things just in terms of the, our use of technology as a society, right? Is sellers, one of their job is they need to speak with people and on the phone or on a video call.
Yep.
And we have generations that are more digitally native that they just haven't done much of that. Right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Why are we assuming that they know how to do it? So, and this is not necessarily a new thing. I mean, companies going back even about 10 years now have been, some bigger companies have been saying, look, we need to train people new to the workforce on just some of these basic skills, like how to talk to somebody on the phone. And that's okay. It's not anybody's fault. It's not the fault of anybody. They don't know how to do it. It's just the world we're in. So, but why don't we train them, right? Yeah. Why don't we train them on some of these basics and give them exposure to it? And that's, I think, a huge shortcoming in most organizations is, we don't focus on training the person before we train them for the role. I think we need more of that. So,
Very well said.
All right. Well, Chris, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much, sir. It's always a pleasure to speak to you, and
likewise,
delight to be a guest. So thanks for having me.
Glad that you were able to join me. So tell people where they can find out more about your book and connect with you.
Yeah, of course. They can find me on LinkedIn, Chris White, Demo Doctor. And the book is available on Amazon, The 6 Habits of Highly Effective Sales Engineers. And if you go to demodoctor.com, you can learn much more about my training and online training and workshops that I run.
Perfect. All right. Well, Chris, as always, pleasure, and look forward to doing it again.
Thank you, Andy, so much. We'll see you.
Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. As always, I'm so grateful for your support of the show. And I want to thank my guest, Chris White, for sharing his insights with us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. So thank you for your help with that. And thank you so much for investing your time with me today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales. We're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.